Hey, welcome to the Parallax Podcast. I'm Liz Brown. In this episode, I'm joined by Barra Foundation President Tina Wall for a conversation on innovation and community building in Philadelphia. The Barra Foundation is a private foundation that invests in innovation in arts and culture, education, health, and human services in the greater Philadelphia region. Tina has served as its president since 2013. She and I discussed how innovation can be leveraged to build stronger and healthier communities in the region. We also talked about the local impacts of COVID-19, Barra's response to the crisis, and long-term effects it will have on communities in our region. Here's our conversation.
I'm really excited to talk to you today, Tina, because your background is also really interesting. And you've been at Barra for 10 years, president for 7 now, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and the Barra Foundation's been around since the 1960s. And for a really long time, it's been a supporter of innovation. How did Barra come to be, and why was it established with this focus?
That's right. Barra was doing innovation way before it got hip, I think. So the foundation was started in 1963 by Robert L. McNeil Jr., who was chairman of McNeil Laboratories, which created Tylenol. And he was, you know, a scientist by training and was always very interested in innovation. For a long time, the mantra of the foundation was innovation, evaluation, and dissemination. So thinking about it from that scientific perspective. And we've been around since 1963. We've evolved over the years, but always have had innovation really at the heart and soul of the foundation and its mission.
And you already touched on this. I mean, innovation now is such a popular concept, and it's often misunderstood and superficially deployed. How would you define the term innovation?
Yeah, innovation means a lot of things to a lot of people, and it's hard to find a word to replace it. But the way we think about innovation is really from our roots in the scientific method from Mr. McNeil. We really think about it from that, thinking about it from R&D, research and development, or experiment, thinking about creating the conditions for innovation, testing something, evaluating it, and then disseminating the lessons learned from that experiment. And I think that's a lot of times when people think about innovation, they think about the next shiny thing, kind of a flash in the pan. We really think about it as a very intentional process that you need all those kinds of parts in order to make it happen and to have it be effective.
Yeah. Do you see specific characteristics necessary for innovation? What conditions?
You know, I think that there are things around having some breathing room to imagine, to look at things from a different perspective. It's interesting. The Bridgespan group did a study, and they looked at different characteristics or different elements that are common to nonprofits when it comes to ones that have a high capacity to innovate. And the 6 things that they name are catalytic leadership, a curious culture, diverse teams, porous boundaries that let insights and information flow, idea pathways, and then ready resources for time, funding, and tools. So I think, you know, having those things in place, and it's interesting, I think in this environment with COVID, you think necessity is the mother of invention, which oftentimes it can be. But I do think that there is an important role that organizations can play in creating space to think and imagine new ways of doing things.
You know, another thing that I hear you're big on is collaboration and partnerships. How do collaboration and partnerships foster innovation in your mind?
Yeah, if there was a piece written by the Kellogg Foundation in 2008 called Intentional Innovation, and talks about creating the conditions for innovation. And if you look at historical periods like the Renaissance, which was clearly one of the greatest times of creativity and imagination, there were different people getting together. There were scientists, there were mathematicians, there were artists. And really having that opportunity to interact among different interest areas is, we think, an opportunity for people to look at things from a different perspective, maybe think about a problem differently, so that someone from arts and culture may bump into somebody from education and strike up a conversation and start thinking about something differently. We all get stuck in our own worlds of thinking, and that cross-fertilization between and among our interest areas of arts and culture, health, human services, and education, we think are an important fertile ground for new thinking. And we're seeing that more and more when we look at vaccine development, open source data, the technology is just enabling us to do it better. I still do think it can be hard when human beings are involved. You know, while it sounds like an easy, it makes a lot of sense, but it does take a lot of resources for organizations to coordinate and collaborate.
That's perfect segue into my next question, which is, why are failure and risk important to achieving innovation?
Yeah, it's back to the experiment. You have to be able to, if you're engaging in exploring new territory, you have to be open and be willing to try something new. And I think everybody who's a human being has tried something new and failed at it and learned from it. You go to the classic 3M example of sticky notes, where they were trying to develop an adhesive, and sticky notes were a failed experiment, which became an amazing tool that all of us use on a daily basis. So I think often when we think about failure, we think about it as very black and white, but oftentimes things that quote unquote fail, there's still lessons that come out of it, or different uses that you may not have imagined in your original problem definition or hypothesis. And understanding that, I'd say one of the big things, Mr. McNeil was ahead of the curve around evaluation. And that's really an important part of how do you know if something's working or not working in order to innovate? And then how do you know if your experiment's working or not? You really have to be able to think about how do you evaluate it and determine that.
It's funny, you brought up 3M as an example. I love 3M, and working with designers, I mean, we use sticky notes a lot in the work that I do, but so many people only know 3M for sticky notes, and they produce, I think, about over 1,000 new products every year.
Yeah.
When you think about innovation, that's one of the first companies that comes to mind for me, because I'm just so impressed by the work that they do. I've been to their main offices in Minneapolis and DC. And I think anyone who is interested in innovation should visit their space, because they have these little innovation museums in both locations, which are really, really cool. So I'm just going to
And there's some industries that are, I think that's great. There's some industries that are, you know, I think Bell Atlantic used to have innovation labs from what I remember. You know, different companies are better at creating that culture and creating those opportunities to do those kinds of things and be creative.
Yeah, I think often when it comes to innovation, it's so easy to point at some of these larger companies doing these really massive projects that get out into the public eye. But you know, it's really important to think about individuals and families and communities. And the Bauer Foundation aims to support and catalyze innovation in areas that improve the lives of low-income individuals, families, and communities. How do you achieve this?
It's a tall order, but we have different parts to our strategy to try to achieve this. And I should say before the pandemic, we were at about a $90 million foundation. We're at about $78 million now with a dip in the market, which means we used to give out about $4 million in funding. And we do that in three ways. So we have our Bauer Awards, our Catalyst Fund, and what we call Beyond the Money, which I'll explain in a moment. And we do it in those four interest areas. So in and across arts and culture, health, human services, and education, which makes us slightly different from a lot of foundations that you'll come across. Our primary lens is really innovation and thinking about it from that perspective, rather than are we looking at pre-K, are we looking at the environment, are we looking at youth homelessness. So we are set up to create innovation that comes up with better solutions for low-income communities and families through those interest areas in and across. And our Bauer Awards provides unrestricted support to organizations, which provides that kind of breathing room to enable people to just have a moment to even, you need that breathing room, flexible dollars to even think about innovation. And we provide $25,000 per year over 2 years to those organizations. The process we use to award those organizations is pretty interesting in that we use a nominating process, and we work with roughly 10 individuals in each of those interest areas to help us identify exemplary organizations from the 5-county region that we serve. So we think that really enables us to reach farther out into the community and create an opportunity to reach out to organizations that may not know us or we may not know them. And the Bauer Awards, again, we have, they're in and across. It's so those organizations can join other leaders of organizations, and we can think more about that cross-fertilization among those, that connectivity among those organizations. So we think about that as creating the conditions for innovation. The Catalyst Fund is really our risk capital for organizations, where we provide opportunities for organizations to experiment and to try something new. And in that, we're looking for things that are new and different. It's really not just a new organization or a new program. There has to be some sort of break from past practice. There's a new development. There's something inventive. We're looking for things that are have the potential to be better than existing solutions. And we're looking for things that we say significant. What we mean by that, we're looking for things that are going to have a ripple effect. To your point a few minutes ago, that it's not always these big institutions that are coming up with these ideas that are going to affect change. We see it across large, small organizations, established new organizations. And we're looking for ideas that are going to really inspire others to do their work differently. They may not be replicated, but it's going to inspire change and influence others. So we're looking for that ripple effect beyond the organization. And then finally, the third part of our strategy is we talk about beyond the money. And those are things that we can do beyond the actual dollars to support that innovation process. So I mentioned we have a grantee event pretty much every year. We bring together our grantees. It's very interesting. We bring them within our interest area. So we'll have a breakfast with our education folks. Then we have an event that we bring them across the different areas. And it's amazing to see the connections that are made and people who don't know each other, our organizations work together all the time, but the executive directors don't know each other. So we're really doing as much as we can to create those opportunities for people to connect and to network. And we do a variety of other things around beyond the money. For example, we will send some of our grantees to the Greater Philadelphia Leadership Exchange, which is run by the Economy League. And that's an opportunity for individuals to come from Philadelphia and get out of the city and go to LA or go to Detroit and get ideas and inspiration from other people. So those are the different parts of our strategy about how we try to achieve that goal.
So y'all do a lot.
There's a lot. Yeah. We're 4 full-time staff, 1 part-time staff. So we have a great team.
Yeah, that sounds like a heavy workload, but a really important one. And I did want to ask about the Catalyst Fund. You know, funding startups is so important, and seed funding and first round funding is just so difficult to get access to. Why specifically is that important to the Bauer Foundation?
We're so lucky that it's part of our history. This has always been an interest since its beginning to really try something new, look at things that have new developments that are inventive. And I think on the flip side of that, there are a lot of foundations that in the 90s and 2000s really moved away from traditional charity and moved into strategic philanthropy. So coming up with what's my strategy around this particular problem and how are we going to deploy our funds to solve it, which is fantastic and has achieved a lot. But I think of it in some ways as just the freedom to experiment and to try something new doesn't exist as much because there are so many other foundations that are looking to figure out what's our impact and how are we, again, affecting change in this particular area. There's an article in the Stanford Social Innovation Review about the reemerging art of funding innovation, which speaks about this. It was a couple of years ago from the Monitor Institute that's done a lot of great work around innovation. And just to this point that there just isn't a lot of room for this openness and experimentation to try new things.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of the same points, the same magic is needed to make a successful accelerator or incubator for businesses. And I think that it's a shame that when people think of innovation, so many people think about technology and they don't think about what innovation really means as a whole and how big it really is. It's so important that there are foundations that are looking at things that are different because, I mean, you mentioned earlier, you're not looking for something that can be replicated. You're not always looking for that. And I think that as an urban planner, wicked problems. I mean, people in urban planning try to solve problems all the time in really creative ways. And often what people are looking for is something that can be replicated in another city, another town, but they really can't be because every place is unique. And I do think Philadelphia is unique. And I think that there are a lot of really interesting people working on solving a lot of interesting and important problems. And not a lot of people realize that how much innovation has been going on in this city is pretty amazing.
And that's what I think is emerging about interesting about the way that we fund innovation, that we're really looking for the wisdom to come from the nonprofits and the communities, because the answers are there. We're just enabling them to create the funding and maybe some other resources to enable that to happen. So I think that's a really important concept to think about when we think about innovation. I think the other area is this notion of trust, which is can be a challenge in foundations. Having been on the other side of things, when you're a development officer, you want to put your best foot forward. You really don't want to let your failures show because you want to get funded again. And we've really tried to create, and our program officers in particular, just really create an opportunity to create trust with organizations so that they are saying, you know, this isn't working and we're going to learn from it. We're going to move on. And I think that that's an enabling factor to innovation as well.
So thinking of trust, one of my first thoughts on that is I actually used to do a lot of grant writing when I first graduated. And I was running programs in West Philly. I'm very familiar with the process of grant writing and looking for funding. And I'm still doing it today with some of the projects that I'm working on. And it's really difficult. And due diligence is such a big part of that often. And right now, so many organizations are taking away some of the upfront due diligence that they do to make sure they're getting money out, which really is trust. I mean, they're putting their trust into people and just hoping for the best. And I think that that's interesting, and I look forward to seeing what happens with that. How has COVID-19 impacted the work that the Barrett Foundation does?
Like everyone else, I think in foundations in particular, I'll speak to that, and for Barra, we have had to move more quickly. Our board has met very frequently. We have been meeting once every 2 weeks since the crisis started. We're taking a break coming up, but we, you know, our board, we met 3 or 4 times, you know, over the course of just a few weeks, which is really unbelievable. They've been really terrific. And we figured out what are we going to do? What's our immediate response? What's our intermediate response? What's our longer term response? And in the immediate response, one of the things we did do that they approved was to deploy some unrestricted dollars to that group of Barra awardees. So there's 108 Barra awardees that since the beginning of the program back in 2013. And rather than have them go through an application process, we said, this is an organization, this is a network. They've been identified by those nominators, which have their tentacles out into the community. We know them, we trust them. It was a $2,500 per organization, so it was not a ton, but it was at least something to help stem the tide somewhat for those organizations. So that was to have that ability to deploy those dollars quickly to organizations we know play important roles in the community was really, I think, critical.
I've been hearing a lot of people say how often they have to have meetings right now.
Yeah.
And it seems, I mean, it's just so overwhelming. I have a lot of meetings right now virtually, but no more than I normally have.
Yeah.
Which is really nice. And I just think it is amazing that people can take the time to get on the phone and do the things that they don't normally do, because boards usually meet like once a month or once a quarter.
We meet 4 times a year, the full board. So they've just been, you know, we keep talking to our board chair, it's, you know, the 100-year flood, and we have to act differently. And I think the other part is that we've contributed to joint funds. So trusting that the organizations that the joint funds, rather than have organizations, nonprofits apply to the Barra Foundation and the Scattergood Foundation, that there's a joint fund where they can apply and receive emergency funds, which seems like a much more efficient process at this point in time. And that those organizations know better what the immediate needs are. You know, if we're looking at the PHL COVID-19 fund, which is the joint fund that's really dealing with health and human services mainly, or if you look at the arts aid fund that we participated in, that's a one-stop place for nonprofits to go for help rather than filling out a number of different applications. It's still hard. There's still more need than there is dollars in those funds for folks. But I think that collaborative nature is another way that we always lean toward that. But I think it's like anything, it's heightened our ability to do that and our urgency to do that. So we supported the Philadelphia Joint Fund and then each in the 4 surrounding counties. And again, knowing that those counties are closest to the communities on the ground and are going to be able to make the decisions, better decisions than we could if we had our own application process.
What kind of information are you getting about what is happening on the ground within communities in Philadelphia?
Yeah, you know, our information is coming from the Philanthropy Network has been doing, Philanthropy Network of Greater Philadelphia, a tremendous job of trying to share information and create a central place for foundations to understand what's happening. You know, the city of Philadelphia is obviously doing a lot of briefings on what's happening and surveys and things about the effect. We also did, this was a small step, but we sent an email out to all of our grantees, and we just set up a Google form and said, give us some feedback about what you're seeing and what you'd like foundations to do. We did that early on just to get some feedback. And I think just the opportunity to for people to voice their opinions so that organizations can hear them is important.
What do you think are the most pressing health and human service needs in the region today?
I think food insecurity is definitely one that we're seeing significantly. Obviously, you see the unemployment rates and joblessness is going to be a major issue. There's the educational impacts on kids and access. You know, the digital divide is real. And behavioral health. You know, I think that those are areas that we'll see it now in this emergency phase. And we're also going to have to think about it as we come into whatever the next phase of this pandemic is.
Yeah, the digital divide is definitely real. It's been very real here in Philadelphia, which is how I got into a lot of the work that I do when I found out how many people actually had access or how few people had access to the internet and a home computer when I moved here. That was just very upsetting to me. And I've been hearing from some people that the pandemic is a class and colorblind equalizer, but the reality is not that. The COVID-19 pandemic has done nothing but magnify and deepen inequalities here in our society. What do you think could be done to lessen the threat to people that are already vulnerable?
I think acting quickly and supporting the immediate needs of people who are already vulnerable is important. Foundations can be maintaining their grant-making budget so that we're supporting organizations in their time of need. You know, I think we have to acknowledge that these disparities exist. We have to recognize that they exist and look at the data and understand them. And I think we have to better understand some of the structural problems and come out of this in a different way. We are seeing the impact on communities. We're seeing the impact on the nonprofit sector. We're seeing, I have a friend who says we're driving a car really fast and we're seeing how good it's working or not working. All the different cylinders are running and we're seeing what's breaking, and it really is highlighting the broken parts of our system. So I think we have to both hold the immediate emergency and also start thinking about why are we here in the first place, and how do we do this differently as we come out of it, and think about how do we do things differently. And there's some ways that foundations can be thinking about that.
Yeah, it's interesting because actually, when I was in the Air Force, a part of my job was to pick up this phone, you know, kind of like a Batman phone. I had this red phone on my desk that when I picked it up, it rang everyone on base. And I had to like listen to everyone's initials. I had to do it every day. It was like the emergency system for the entire base, where I pick up this phone and do a roll call with everybody else that's in their offices and let them know, you know, what's going on. And I feel like I've been through so much training in terms of leadership and just things that most people haven't been through. And even I feel super unprepared for what's happening right now. And I do wish that there was some kind of way that I could pick up my phone and let everyone know that this is actually a very serious thing. This is really affecting a lot of people. And I just don't see how we're going to come out of this in a good position, at least not immediately, but I'm hoping for the best. And I think that my mindset is, not to say I'm being negative, I'm a pretty positive person, but I haven't been happy with the disparities that underrepresented founders specifically have to go through. And this is just making it so much worse. And I don't think that we really have a grasp on what the impact is going to be as a whole yet. That's just my thoughts.
I agree. I mean, I do think that there's more that's going to happen. And I do think it's disturbing and frustrating because it does feel like it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. but we're resilient, and there is so much creativity and passion, and particularly in Philadelphia, there's just a somewhat of a groundswell of at least the people that I'm talking to and hearing from about, you know what, now's the moment and now's the time to change. And this is where we're going to be tested. So let's think about, how do we do things differently? How do we use things like impact investing? How do we listen to communities better? How do we break down the power dynamics between nonprofits and foundations? How do we think differently about the racial wealth gap and not just think about creating jobs, but building wealth in communities? So the hope is that this information, people will become more aware of these challenging, really disturbing disparities and think about, let's stop attacking the problem in the same way and let's think about different ways of doing it and approaching it. And let's look at ways. I think one of the challenges with innovation is often we throw the baby out with the bathwater. So if there's something that works and it's going well, let's do more of it. But if it doesn't work, let's change gears. And there's clearly, like you're saying, there's a lot of things that don't work in our communities. I've been having conversations around small business. You know, small businesses and nonprofits, there's a lot of similarities in them. And a lot of small businesses, it's the lifeblood of our communities. And the access to capital, like you were saying, you know, you're talking about startups, but even small businesses, the access to capital, it's not the same. Look at the PPP program and the rollout. There had to be advocacy so that you could get more dollars into the hands of community development financial institutions so you could reach micro businesses. One of the things that our board did really quickly, again, I was just, they were, showed such leadership, was to provide a program-related investment, which is a form of impact investing, to a CDFI called WRC, W-R-C, to enable there to be access to PPP. We created a bridge funding to small minority women-owned businesses and micro-businesses. So there are ways that we can do things differently, and there are opportunities to expand access and to expand resources that are there.
And we've talked a little bit about expanding resources, and you know, I think that capacity building is really high on that list for me. Do you have any ideas on how how we might build the capacity to get through this?
It's going to be difficult because the city is going to have fewer dollars to deal with. But I think we're going to have to, I think we're going to have to think differently about our capacity. So for example, foundations, we need to come together, particularly in Philadelphia. We do not have as many of the large foundations as maybe other cities have. So some of us need to come together to think bigger about how to support some of the needs of the nonprofit sector so that we can do it better and maybe address some of those capacity issues. And I think that there has to be, we have to think about how do we work not just in our own silos, but how do we work with government? How is there government innovation? How are we leveraging our dollars in a way that is most effective? How is it not just nonprofits and government, but also thinking about businesses and thinking about how do we create more jobs and more wealth creation for people so we don't have to need so much capacity down the road?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think capacity building is ever going to just not be necessary, but I hope that a lot less of it will be, because it's just been, it just feels so scary right now. It's such a scary time for small business owners and startup founders. Right now, what can people do to help as far as the Barra Foundation goes?
Yeah, for the Barra Foundation, you know, I would say Philanthropy Network of Greater Philadelphia, which I've mentioned before, they have a great place on their website where they, you can contribute to joint funds. Individuals are welcome to support. There are funds for the arts. There's funds for small businesses. There's funds for food needs. You know, you can contribute directly to organizations you know are doing great work. There's also, the city has an office of volunteerism where if you're able to and you can participate, that's an opportunity to get engaged. Those are some direct ways that you can think about contributing to, at least financially now, to organizations.
You know, why Philadelphia? You know, what is it about Philadelphia that makes it special in your mind?
Gosh, so many things. I'm from this area. I think that there are a lot of people who just feel really passionate. I think Philadelphia, there's so much history, there's so much creativity. The arts and culture sector is vibrant here. We're a walkable city, and I just think it's an incredible place where you can test new ideas and come up with great inventions and innovations.
I completely agree with all of that, because I do think that Philadelphia is the future. I think that we've really got something here that has yet to be discovered by some people, but those of us that are here already know.
There's a lot of grit and resilience here.
Yeah, definitely is.
Homegrown and people who've moved here. So I think there's a lot of opportunity, like you said.
Yeah, no, definitely, because I've been here for about 9 years now from the Hudson Valley, and I miss home all the time, but this is also my home, and I can't really imagine a better place for me to be, even at this time going through the pandemic, than Philadelphia. I think that if there was ever a place that will come out of this strong, Philadelphia will probably be that place, because of the resiliency and the perseverance of the people here that are doing this hard work. So
yeah, we're a city of neighborhoods, and it's a lot of great communities here.
Thanks so much for listening, and a very special thanks to Tina for taking the time to talk with us. If you'd like to share any thoughts on this conversation, be sure to leave a review in Apple Podcasts. You can also connect with us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or send an email to info@parallaxcollab.com.